Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm very excited to see a lot of people back today and maybe some new faces. So I'll introduce myself again. My name is Allison Gray, and I am a professor at St. Mary's University in San Antonio, Texas, where I teach New Testament and early Christian literature. So I am here at Holden to run a bunch of test cases by an engaged, thoughtful audience, and I am going to teach an undergraduate course this fall semester on the topic of kinship and family metaphors in the New Testament. So some of what's happening here is going to happen in my class. I'm also trying to work on a book that is for a lay audience. I come from a Catholic tradition, so for Catholic lay people, to think about the metaphors that are used in the New Testament to describe our role in church community. And then to think about how these metaphors were being used in the first century. What did the original authors mean when they said, you're a child of God, you are a soldier of Christ? And what do we mean today? And are those the same thing? If they are the same thing, is that okay? If they're not the same thing, is that okay? So what I want to do with you guys is look at a metaphor a day. And today we are talking about children and childhood. So the plan for the session is to look at some texts together. And I will give you some background information on the first century context. So when we're specifically looking at Paul, for the most part, and in Paul's letters, when he uses the term child or childhood, what would his original readers have heard? And what context was he living in? What would he have meant when he said, you are a child? So we're going to talk about the social reality of the world that Paul lived in, the world that he was writing to, mainly the Gentile world. So I'm leaving out some of the Jewish background here and talking specifically about Gentile communities, Greeks, Romans in the empire. And we're going to think about how those metaphors Paul was using could have created a sense of belonging for the Christian community of his time. And then we're going to jump into the present day and look at a few case studies. I have some information that I'll share with you, but I'm really interested in hearing your thoughts. When you hear the word child today, what does that mean to you? What are some of the expectations we have about and around children in contemporary American society and in the American Christian church? And then the question that we'll end with, and I want to leave some time to talk about this, is, if we continue to use this metaphor of children of God for ourselves as community, what are some of the dangers associated with that, and what are some of the benefits associated with using that metaphor? So that's where we're going with the conversation. I'm very excited to hear from you. Yesterday we were asked, if you speak, there are some microphones hanging here, but please speak up so that they can pick up your voice and so that everyone in the room can hear you. So I always like to start with the text. This is from 1 Corinthians. And Paul is speaking to this community in Corinth, a Greek city that is now part of the Roman Empire. And he is concerned in specifically this context about divisions in the community. So he's going to be using language to try to draw people together. So here's one way he attempts to do that. I am not writing this to make you ashamed, but to admonish you as my beloved children. For though you might have 10,000 guardians in Christ, you do not have many fathers. Indeed, in Christ Jesus, I became your father through the gospel. I appeal to you then, be imitators of me. For this reason, I sent you Timothy, who is my beloved and faithful child in the Lord, to remind you of my ways in Christ Jesus, as I teach them everywhere in every church. So as you look at this text this morning, imagine that it is written to you, right? You are the beloved children receiving this message from Paul. What is this saying about what it means to be a child?
That you're ignorant.
Where do you see ignorance?
Well, he's not shaming us, but he's admonishing us like foolish children who don't know any better.
Okay, so there is some sort of power dynamic here, and some of it has to do with knowledge, right? There's a knowledge difference. So maybe children are those who do not have full knowledge or who are ignorant in some way.
Yes, a child needs authority. And authority comes from the father as opposed from a general guardian.
Excellent. So they're actually a child has a guardian. And yesterday, if you were here, we talked about slaves in the household. Sometimes that guardian is a slave from the Roman household who is in charge of the child's education and upbringing. But a guardian is not sufficient. There has to be a father. So there's layers of authority, and the child is really at the bottom rung here, right?
Is this guardian here the pedagogus we were talking about before?
Let me see where we are. I did find a Greek New Testament over in the Bible, so I have that. Over in the library, so I have that with me today. 1 Corinthians 14. Pause for searching. Okay. It is paedagogos. So this is the usually a household slave who is in charge of the education of children. So you have a guardian who is over you. And that is really interesting with what you said about authority, right? Because the pedagogue is for training the child, but the father's role is something different. Yes.
So the father implies someone to be imitated.
Yes.
Right? And imitate me, I think, rather than somebody else.
Yes.
So how's that different from pedagogy?
That's a really great question, because in the ancient world, a lot of the way that education happened was through holding up models, right? The way that you learn is by looking at what other people have done. You read a lot of biographies, you say, this person has so many good virtues, you should also live like them. Go ahead.
I'm wondering because he is directly in line with Jesus. I mean, it's like levels of authority, and he takes himself back to the great, the ultimate authority.
So there is this idea, right? Paul has ways that are in Christ Jesus that he teaches in every church, so you should be an imitator of Paul in the same way that Paul is an imitator of Christ. He uses that exact chain elsewhere. It's not as clear here, but I think that's definitely in his mind. He becomes their father through the gospel, and maybe that's a different kind of fatherhood than something that would be constituted by teaching. Yes?
Yeah. I'm bothered by a lot of Paul, but
sure. Many of us are.
If this is really clear to me, I don't know why I've missed it before. I'm the closest thing you're ever going to see to Jesus, yeah, is what he's saying, and I'm your father. It's kind of like, if you're not into patriarchy, here's the invitation.
Mm-hmm. Right? Paul is the authority figure. The guardians are in a temporary role, right? And here's another difference between a guardian and a father. Your father is your origin, right? Your family, and you as a child are an heir of that father, and you are going to imitate the father in taking over the family line. The pedagogue is a temporary guardian who is going to educate you and bring you up, but eventually, if that pedagogue is a slave, you are going to have authority over the slave in the household, right? So you are going to take on the father's authority eventually. But the dynamic here, absolutely, is you are a child, the father is in charge of you. And you are to be disciplined by the father. That's where the admonishment comes from. It's authority, it's intellectual, but the father has control. Yes?
So it's really interesting that as he's taking on this father, Paul is taking on the father role, he's sending Timothy, who's his child, to them to be the teacher. So as another guardian, in terms of if you're going to do structure.
This gets very complicated, right? Yeah. So we all of a sudden have Timothy, who is another child, but this child, having been trained and brought up by Paul, can be trusted to have authority over the other children.
Yeah. Right.
So we have layers.
Yeah.
Right?
He was trained by his father.
Yes.
Not by a guardian.
Yes. Any other thoughts about what it means for you to be the child in this situation? What is this implying about your role?
You have no power.
Yeah. I want to push back on that a little bit. So the suggestion is that you as a child have no power. Do you have power?
Yes. Yeah.
What is the power?
Disobey.
You could disobey. Very good. Okay, so you have the power to choose to obey, to learn. Good.
Children are still members of the household proper. They're not slaves. They're not.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Right? That they can imitate. That there is this hope that the child can step up as a full member of the household. We're not there yet, but the expectation is that the child will adopt authority.
Children are the disciples. I mean, basically, they're the students of the body.
Mm-hmm. So,
but you got to deal with Paul's ego in this too.
Right. Well, in Paul's ego, so we think about Paul's letters as being occasional letters, and not that he writes them every once in a while, right? But they're responding to specific situations in church communities. And one of the big questions in Corinth is, has Paul's authority been subverted or brought into question by others who are in the community because they decided we know how to do Christianity, we can take off on ourselves, or do they have other teachers there who are competing with Paul? So he is asking, be imitators of me. I'm sending my agent, Timothy, who is also my child, to teach you how to get in line, right? Which maybe we can see that as about ego. Maybe we can see that a little more generously as Paul being very concerned that he has taught the message and people are subverting the message, right? So we need to get back on the right page. Yes.
Well, we're talking about faith being passed down from generation to generation.
Yes.
Isn't that the important thing that he's, like we hear about the church fathers? And so Paul is like a father passing on the faith to the next generation.
Yes, right. So this is, I became your father, be imitators of me. And the whole point is to be reminded of the message that is taught everywhere in the church. So the children become heirs of what Paul is teaching. If we look into the pastoral epistles, which are sort of a second generation Pauline writing, the idea there is you've received the message, so hand it on as you received it. So there's this patrimony or inheritance that goes forward. So to give us a little more information, I think you're picking up on a number of things that are true of the ancient world. So let me walk through some ways that children were seen during Paul's time. This is one of my favorite monuments from the ancient world. It's in Rome. It's called the Areopagus, which is the Altar of Peace. From the reign of Augustus. I love it because of these children and their little mischievous faces on here. But what you see, even in this labeled version, is that the adults are labeled. We need to know who the adults are, but it's not as important for us to know who the children are. Yes?
In Paul's world, and in the ancient world, children were almost disenfranchised. I mean, they were not considered as people until they reach a certain age. And so consequently, they wouldn't be named. And number two, I mean, when Paul speaks, he's really speaking as a power figure.
And this is authority he's claimed for himself.
Who have it's not power. They have nothing in the relationship with the rest of the world. They're just simply like disenfranchised until they reach a certain point.
That's actually an open question, whether the people Paul was speaking to had power and authority, right? Because we do get some hints from Acts and from some of the people that Paul names in his letters that he was working with not just the poorest of the poor, but he was speaking to an elite audience who had wealth and social status.
I didn't mean that. When he uses the word child, he's using it to describe a group of people that he feels he has power over because they, child, doesn't have any ability to speak or have any information of its own.
And it is, so this is the dynamic that's really interesting in the ancient world. So children were a valuable resource. And I use that word deliberately. They could be used by the family. So this shows a really sort of lovely scene. The family is headed to a religious ritual together. This is on public display, right? The children are part of the family and they're part of what the family can show in public to display their wealth and their power and their status. We have letters from the first century as part of the documentary papyri, and those are just texts that people have found on ancient trash heaps. The papyrus survives, and these are personal letters that were sent back and forth across the empire. So in the first century, we have some letters, one from a husband to his wife. He's away on a journey, and his wife is about to give birth, so he writes back and he says, well, if we have a son, please give him this name. If we have a daughter, please dispose of her. Right? So we know that there was a practice in the ancient world of infant exposure. And so children were a resource, but they were also a drain on resources. So especially in less wealthy families, female children were a liability because you had to pay a dowry for a female child. Women were not usually educated, right? So that child was not necessarily going to be adding any benefit to your household. So sometimes the decision was made to expose an unwanted child. So put them out on that trash heap where the papyri are disposed of. Sometimes those children were picked up and brought into slavery by other families. Sometimes they were left to die. That was actually a practice. I think we hear about it, we say, well, that happened in Sparta, right? And it's only this military society where they valued men more than women. That actually happened throughout the empire. But during the time of Augustus, there were actually laws passed to encourage people to have more children. And one of those laws would give additional financial benefits and freedom to women if they had a certain number of children. So there was encouragement to increase the size of the family. So we've got these sort of conflicting ideas that children bring a high cost, but at the same time, it will benefit the empire and your family can gain things if they have more children. But there was a different value for male and female children, different treatment for male and female children during this time period.
Just have a little objection maybe, but when we speak of Paul having power,
yes.
I'm thinking of that power as the power of Jesus, the power of love, the power of giving your life for others. And it seems to me that's very much part of Paul. Even though he may insist that, you know, I brought you into the Christian faith, I have that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But I somehow don't see that so much as dictatorial.
No, I think that's fair. So the objection to when we talk about Paul having power, this is power that Paul has claimed for himself in light of his experience of meeting the risen Christ, right? He says, I have had this encounter. It has changed the way that I think about myself and my position in the world. It has changed the way that I think about what it means to be a person of God in covenant relationship with God. And so I have authority that is the authority to imitate Christ, which means to serve, right? I think that in the letters, we can sometimes detect moments where he is using that authority to instruct in a way that for some people comes across as dictatorial.
Yeah. I'm just thinking of Jesus when he says, the great ones, you know, have authority, but it's not that way among you.
Right.
But he still would call it authority.
And Paul is navigating between the teachings of Jesus that he knows, the experience of Jesus that he has in this, what I would say is maybe a mystical encounter, and then the realities of the world where he's trying to build communities and talk to them about how to live together peacefully and within a Roman society that is different from the society that he's trying to build. Right.
Is the Christian church at this time rescuing the exposed children too?
Not that we know of. There aren't records to say that. Yeah. So children were valued, but I think a lot of the considerations of children in the ancient world centered around economic questions, right? Not everything, but some of it was certainly economic. If you go around another side of the Areopagus, away from this imperial family portrait, you see something that's a little more symbolic. And children were thought of as a sign of richness, fertility, promise for the future, right? I think that resonates with us a little bit today, right? This children are the future. That was also true in the Roman world. And I think this image that we see here, the seated woman with two children, she's surrounded by animals who represent the sea. Over on the right there, you have a sea monster. You've got some livestock in the bottom, and then a bird from the air. So this is an image that uses children and other symbols to represent Roman power, solidity, so that children could be used symbolically to signify potential. I'm seeing a face.
Oh, facial expression. I mean, over here, it looks like Liga and the Swan.
It does, right? So these are references that may resonate with people who are familiar with Greek myth. Yes. But the ability to have and raise children represents wealth in a lot of ways, because the reality of there was a very high infant mortality rate, right? So if you could have children and keep them alive, that was a very good thing in the ancient world as well. So while children were resources and sometimes they were expendable because they came with a high cost, you have both sides the same way we do today, right? Some people want children, some people do not want children. It's always a question. So speaking about the differential treatment of children, we saw this image yesterday. So there's a teacher, a child, and then a paidagogos, usually the household slave who's in charge of the education of children. So this shows some of the investment that could be put into the next generation. You'll notice that is a young male child, and he is rather well-dressed, and there's a very expensive kind of instrument there, and there are two adults who are devoting their time and attention to him. Education was reserved for elite males. Most elite male children were educated. They at least learned some functional literacy, so they could read, decipher texts, usually write a little bit. Girls were not usually educated. Only very wealthy men continued on to sort of secondary education, which would involve training in rhetoric so that they could enter into public life, or even further training in philosophy, medicine, or law. That was sort of the upper echelons of society. Males specifically would continue on to that kind of education. But this was a big financial investment because you would hire a teacher. Most of those teachers were paid by private families. A lot of time went into the training of children. So I've talked to, yeah, please.
Well, I was just wondering if this scroll says anything.
Not that I can really tell.
Yes, it does.
It does, but.
Can you read? Just curious.
I cannot.
Spare the rod and spoil the
child. There were a lot of messages about discipline and education, yes. So some of those tell us that children were to be seen and not heard, right? Their opinions were not necessarily valued. But all of this training and investment would go towards making them into the next generation of elite males who could run the city and the empire.
I'm curious about the role of the slave.
Yes. So we spoke a little bit yesterday about this specific role of a paidagogos, who was usually a household slave who was in charge of the raising of children. So escorting them through the city, getting them to and from their education, sometimes in the household doing the training for how to read. And there were female slaves who were hired as nurses to raise, sort of as a wet nurse, right, to raise the child when they were an infant. To work alongside the mother in that capacity. But there were specific roles in the household. So these were servants who were under the authority of the father, but also to assist the child. So many children had very close relationships with these particular household slaves. These are some portraits, mummy portraits from Egypt. So we tend to think of ancient art looking a lot like this, right? It's very flat, two-dimensional. There was more realistic art in the ancient world. And these portraits are, I think, very striking, right? And there are some funerary reliefs from the ancient world. I did not put one of those, but often there are funerary reliefs of children. Children were highly valued and loved and cared for. So I had talked about some of the economic implications of having a child and the practical side of it, but people love their children. Children love their parents. There are many letters we have from the ancient world of children away for training, sort of that secondary education, who write home to their families with wonderful messages for their parents and thankful for their parents and the training they've received. But the mummy portraits would be painted at some point in a person's life, and then when the person passed away and the body was mummified, this portrait would be placed over the face so that you could see an image of the deceased. And so we have quite a lot of these. Many museums have a collection of the mummy portraits. But these are of younger people. And obviously the investment of time and effort into creating these portraits to bring a little bit of the personality of the person into the portrait, I think reflects the way in which children were seen as valued members of the household, right, and members of the family. So I think it's a complicated situation in the ancient world that is not quite like the way we think of our children today. They did not have the same kinds of freedom. There was not the same equal investment in education for all children. But they were loved and valued. So I want to look at another text together. Knowing what we know about children's role in the household, children's role in wider society, right? Somewhat invisible, but set up to become the next generation of leaders. I wanted to look at this passage from Galatians and think about how Paul is using the image of children and childhood to create a community where people belong. He says, "My point is this. Heirs, as long as they are minors, are no better than slaves, though they are the owners of all the property. But they remained under guardians and trustees until the date set by the father. So with us, while we were minors, we were enslaved to the elemental spirits of the world. But when the fullness of time had come, God sent his son, born of a woman, born under the law, in order to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive adoption as children. And because you are children, God has sent the spirit of his son into our hearts, crying, 'Abba, Father.' So you are no longer a slave, but a child. And if a child, then also an heir through God." So thoughts or reactions to the way that a child, being a child, creates belonging. Yes.
I think it ties our faith to an elemental metaphor that we all know, hopefully, from our own experience. And so it's kind of one of those sermons you might not forget, or one of those images you might not forget, how to understand yourself. But at certain points it made me feel, well, maybe this isn't such a great parallel, but I think the main message saves it. The deficiencies fall away a little bit, and the main message of that elemental relationship between mother and child, father and child, mm-hmm. as one of the most accessible images we have of God. So. If that's an accessible image of God, then being a child is an accessible image for us.
Yeah, thank you very much for that observation, right? This is one of the most powerful metaphors, and it's used throughout the Hebrew Bible and into the New Testament as well, this idea of God as parent, human being as child, right? So when we think about it in that context, we are children of God. That image is very accessible to us. Yes?
Well, it seems that what Paul's saying is that prior to Jesus, kids were slaves, children were slaves. They were valued, you know, all the first thirds of that. And then with the arrival of Jesus, children were actually elevated. Mm-hmm. Become children rather than slaves.
Right, I think this gives us some insight to add to our conversation from yesterday about what it means to be a slave of Jesus Christ. Slaves are really the lowest of the low in the household, right? To be elevated means to move from being a slave to being a child. So now you're part of the authority structure under which the slaves must operate. So there is this shift that happens, but it maybe downgrades that metaphor of slavery even more than what we were working with.
Maybe this is just an English problem, so we need a Greek lesson.
Uh-huh.
At the end, you are no longer a slave but a child, and if a child then also an heir. Does that word child imply minor child, or is it also a grown-up child?
So in verse 7, right, you are no longer a slave but a child. You're not a doulos, which is a slave, but a huios. So this is the masculine noun for a son.
Right. Okay.
So a natural born child of the family, which is interesting because he's used the idea of adoption to become a son, but he is using the word son. So you would be the kleronomos, which is the one who by law receives the inheritance. The one who everything would be left to in the will, because you are the son.
So our English problem is when we use child in order not to be gendered.
Right.
It implies... a minor.
Ooh, yes, okay, interesting. So you could be an adult son in the family, right? I think that it's actually a fair translation to use child, and we could still perhaps mean adult child. I love this distinction. But huios means son, but if you had a collective group of children, you might still use the masculine noun for the collective. So this is like a language like Spanish or Latin or other languages that you might know. If there's a group of mixed male and female, you might use the masculine collective to talk about that group. Are there words for young women and for girls? Yes. Are they used here? No. But it may be fair to use the word child, but technically it is. You are a son. Yeah.
Right. So you're using, I don't know what version both your scripture texts are from.
These are from NRSV.
Okay. Yeah. So they're trying to be more inclusive. In the original, is it sonship as a metaphor for belonging? And is it you're no longer a slave but a son, and if a son, then also an heir? I'm trying to remember.
It is wheel, so it is son.
Yeah.
Sometimes he does describe people as children. Mm-hmm. So I'm sort of mixing things up a little bit.
Okay.
Here. Yeah.
Is right in the beginning, it says, you know, heirs
mm-hmm.
are no better than slaves. But back at the bottom, he says, so you're no longer a slave. But up above, you were already an heir. Now you're not a slave, but a child. And if a child, then an heir. So it's kind of circular.
And he does, when he says in verse 3, while we were minors, he's using the word nepioi, which means infants.
Oh babies.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, so he is using children at different ages here. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a through line through here that on maturity.
Yes.
Right? And that there's a change that happens. So if we think back to sort of older models, we don't run into this so much in our culture, but you know, in where the oldest son inherits everything, if he's 7 or 6 when his parents die, he's still the heir.
Yeah.
But he's unable to control his property until he reaches maturity, right?
He has an adult guardian who's assisting him.
Yes. Right, and so he's got these adult guardians or this pedagogoi or these other people who are running the household until he can be trusted with whatever, mm-hmm. right? So we've got these regents. And so it's interesting to me that these elemental spirits of the world are in some sense working as these pedagogoi, and then that relationship gets switched with some kind of maturity that happens in Christ. So the coming of Jesus somehow changes humanity in such a way that it becomes adult, right? That it's able to sort of take its place in whatever the thing it's supposed to be. So it's not, what's interesting to me is it's not a metaphor of sin.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
a metaphor of adulthood, of growth, of being able to take the place that was already determined.
And it's about adoption, right? We receive adoption as children. This is not something that we ourselves did, right? It's the fullness of time came, Jesus arrived, and now we can be adopted. So it's not our own action.
Yeah.
It's not anything that we had to change. Now, elsewhere in Paul, it is about we need to change and we need to do the work to mature. But here it is about the action of God and of Christ to adopt us. And adoption was a regular practice in the ancient world, especially in Roman society. When if you were adopted, you then became the heir, and there was no question about your authority over that household. So it's interesting to see moving from slavery, from being guarded, to becoming the one who will inherit, who has authority over the household. Yes, here.
Maybe I'm reading more into this, but one of the things that I love about this is the fact that we're not just children of a God that is powerful, but Abba, Father. We are children of love. Mm-hmm. So as a child of God, we are loved. And that just that one word makes a huge difference to me personally in the passage.
Absolutely, right? Because we could be looking at sort of the economic implications. Now you're the heir. But there is this something going on in our hearts. It is a deeper kind of transformation, or a different kind of transformation, that is not just legal. He is playing on the legal valences here, and I think that's important when we're talking about what it means to be a son of God. It is an official status, and it comes with responsibilities and authority, but it also has an emotional dimension.
It's interesting, it relates also, because of course Paul is thoroughly familiar with the Hebrew scriptures.
Yes.
And so I'm thinking about our first reading for Sunday, in which Abraham is complaining, isn't that this Sunday or was this last week? That Abraham is complaining that he doesn't have any children, and so a slave born in his household is going to be his heir. So I don't know what to do with that, except...
Well, and I think Paul continues on in Galatians 4. This is the chapter where he does take on the Abraham, Sarah, Hagar story, right? And just this whole allegorical reading and interpretation of what it means to be a child of the slave, or what it means to be the heir. Yeah, I think there's a lot there.
Well, and this is the whole thing with... He's speaking with the Greeks, right? And they were not children of God in Paul's Hebrew world, right? And so isn't adoption also what, through Christ, what allows the Greeks, the Romans, all the other people of the world to be adopted in, grafted on?
Right, so in Galatians he uses the image of adoption for talking about how Gentiles are incorporated. He also uses faith, right? In Romans he uses this image of grafting onto the tree. There are a lot of images that he uses to try to explain how this incorporation of Gentiles works. But yes, if we're thinking about a Gentile audience, so I want to bring that question to us, actually. How does that image of adoption work for us today? So if Paul is writing to people who had not considered themselves as children of the God of Israel, right? He's trying to incorporate a new community and say, you are also adopted. When we read this today, as Christians and members of the existing community, does that image of adoption do anything for us?
As an adoptee, yes.
Okay, would you be okay saying a little bit more about that?
Well, I've always known I was adopted, but I was also known, I've always been part of the family.
And yeah.
My family's always been totally, completely, absolutely beloved. So I guess when I hear adoption, I hear it as being a complete acceptance,
mm-hmm.
not something that's, you know, we've got this child.
Right? No, thank you for that, because I think where I was going with that question was, if we as a community of Christians are sort of thinking ourselves, especially if we are born into that tradition and have stayed with it our entire lives, am I thinking of myself as someone who already was an heir, or am I thinking of myself as someone who has become an heir? later on in life? What would that mean, right? So that image of adoption or of a change in status becomes an interesting question when we think about what it means to become part of the community. Yeah.
As an adoptive parent to a Native American child, mm-hmm. I can say that it means you forget any of that. If the child had, my daughter had an unusual teething pattern, and I remember saying to her pediatrician, well, I think I or my husband had that. You just totally forget.
Yeah. This is really interesting. Thank you. Yes.
I'm a mother of an adopted child and also biological children. And we say in our family that there are two ways to enter a family, birth or adoption, and they're exactly equal in the law and in practice, that they're the same thing. Yeah.
I might add that I know my birth family very well mm-hmm. and have a very close relationship with them, which came very late in life, in 95, so.
Sure. Yeah.
But that didn't, so there is that idea that, you know, I was once here and now here. And it didn't change anything in terms of my adoptive family mm-hmm. and my relationship with my adoptive family.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask too, what about the legal inheritance component of this? In the ancient world, that would have been a very powerful, compelling image for people, right? Now you are part of the household, you are going to take over, you are going to have the responsibility, the public view of being the representative of this household. Is that something that resonates with us today in the same way? Is that what it means to be a child in the family?
I wondered, as we were reading it before, does this mean we're all going to be the oldest son? You know, the one to...
Yeah, sure. Right. Sure.
Which seems logistically kind of impossible.
Right. So there are people who are potentially going to feel excluded by this, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like women.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're more likely to make it divided equally. I'm just redoing my will, and both of my sons inherit equally.
Yeah. Yeah. So when we think about what it means to be an heir, we think of now we are sharing in something equally with the other children in the household.
I think
and that's not necessarily what Paul is talking about. Yeah.
I think there's a piece of this that, primogeniture is not great. Right? But there's a piece of it that we can sort of forget in that, which is in the ancient world, because of primogeniture, the household stays together as a unit going forward.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to, I think of my own family, you know, after my grandmother died, I have almost no contact with my cousins at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because we're not a family unit. We think of these things a little bit more sort of financially, and finances are pretty easy to divvy up and move on. And so the sort of this is perhaps more of my family business than you want to know, but the pre-existing sort of difficulties in that family no longer being held together by any sort of visible family structure, even my grandmother, the matriarch, we're allowed to sort of go their separate ways. And that I think, is a problem with the metaphor, right, in
mm-hmm.
some ways, that we don't have a sense of these extended family units continuing through time.
Yeah, I think what it means to inherit now means usually something financial. You're given the property, or you're given the financial gain, and then you continue on with your life. I think what it means to inherit in the ancient world is much more, now I'm in charge of this family unit, and I have to take over the household, including all the family members and slaves, right? Yeah.
So in the church,
mm-hmm.
To inherit a responsibility for the household and the future implies some kind of institutional maintenance.
Yes.
Which we seem to be allergic to. Are we preparing another generation to receive that, and do they want it?
And I think that's one of the really interesting challenges with the metaphor of child for me, is if perpetually we identify as the children, where does that step up to authority and taking charge come from, right? And so it's interesting to see that power dynamic with Paul. Paul is giving us the example, be imitators of me, but do we ever stop just being imitators and actually become the ones who are in charge of the next generation, right? And what does that look like to share that responsibility as children in a single household? So this takes me back to your earlier question about when you say child, and it's actually the word huios or son, does that mean adult child or does it really mean child? So I think we associate it with being immature, younger, ignorant, not having the authority, when I think this metaphor could be inviting us to step up. But I'm not sure that that's our natural inclination. When we see the word child, we think the ones who are not in charge of things.
Just an observation and a question. In marriage and family literature, family is more and more associated with emotional bonding,
yes,
rather than with biological bonding. How does that affect the reading of these verses?
That is a wonderful question. What do you guys think?
I don't think it's being addressed at all. In terms of the emotional aspect, it seems to be more financial and biological.
But, there's still the ABBA. Sorry.
And I'm not sure, and this could be a wildly off interpretation, but I'm not sure if there's not a transformation from the first heir as the traditional financial heirs of the property down to the last use of heir as through God, as an heir of the kingdom of God.
Mm-hmm.
And that opens it up to an entirely different sense, mm-hmm, of inheritance.
Through the agency of the Spirit, right? And I would take that final through God as God is the one who has made this happen, right? And because you are children, you've received adoption, God has sent the Spirit of His Son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. So there is now, I think, some equality with Jesus, right? You are a child in the same way that Jesus is a child, right? You are taking on that sonship, which is sharing in the inheritance that Christ also had, right? So does that have an emotional impact? Absolutely. I'm not sure. We have another passage, and so I want you to bring that question back when we look at the other passage. When we think about family and what it means to be a child in the family, where does the emotion come in? I want to save that for our final passage. Yeah.
What does Abba mean?
Abba is a Hebrew diminutive for father. It's daddy.
But it's more, it's
it's more intimate. Yeah, it
well,
is.
Well, it's like instead of calling your father, you call him daddy or papa or whatever.
Yeah.
It's a an endearment,
yeah,
term as opposed to an official title.
Trudy had an experience at Kamiza. Don't know if it's biblical, but when she was, fourth grade, a child in her class had found out he was adopted. He was quite upset, and the teacher's trying to comfort him by saying, you know, natural-born children, the parents don't have any choice. But your parents chose you. Trudy said she didn't know I was adopted. Her buttons are popping.
Well, and so this also, there is this question of choosing to be part of the community, right? And what it means to be an heir and take up that responsibility versus to be a child in the household. Did you get to choose that household for yourself? Yeah.
You are chosen,
yes,
to be a part of the household.
Originally, it's if you are a male, this is really great news for you.
Yes.
But we're not addressing the fact that it's we have tried to make it inclusive to include women, girls and women.
Mm-hmm.
But originally it was not good news for girls and women. It was just, you're what you are, but.
Well, although I would say, I think we're fairly justified in trying to push it towards child because of what Paul does elsewhere in Galatians, right? In 3:28, where he famously says there's no male or female.
Right.
Then he says there is no slave or free. So he's using these images at the same time as he's trying to completely undercut them and say they don't matter anymore. So it's really interesting to think about the metaphors and when they're working and when they're not. So you're right, the social reality is, as a woman reading this or hearing this in the first century, would this sound like any kind of change at all? I'm not sure.
You gotta love it. Paul says, you are all sons of God.
Ladies. What a mess for transgender people.
I wanted to briefly sort of, this is my sort of challenge, right? So what are the contemporary understandings of children that we bring to our reading? So I just have a couple of things to throw into the mix. I'd love to hear your ideas as well. I wanted to talk about child labor. I think we tend to, I'm going to speak for myself, right? When I think of children as those who are going to school, who don't have work responsibilities for the most part, right? Their job is education, and they're going to grow up and then begin working. The reality is that, particularly for farm labor, children of any age can work on their parents' farms. If you're 10 years old, you can be hired to work on farms for short-term harvest labor. If you are 12, you can do, if you have parental permission, legally you can do non-hazardous farm work outside of school hours. You're still supposed to go to school. At 16, a child can legally do any job on any farm. And that's 2 years younger than in most other industries, right? If we think about more at-risk populations, migrant farm workers, I found some educational statistics. When I think of children, I think, okay, they're going to school. But approximately one out of every 500 children whose parents are migrant laborers finishes grade school. One out of every 5,000 finishes high school. And there is no case on record of a child of a migrant laborer ever receiving a college diploma. And that's from August 14th this year.
Excuse me, where did that come from?
This was from an American Public Media report called Children in the Fields. And there was, I think it was on a number of NPR stations.
How do they define a migrant worker?
Ooh.
I can give you 100 examples of college educated farm worker children.
Sure. Farm worker. I think they were talking about undocumented laborers who came in, and so there may be other complications with how we're getting documentation.
They're undocumented children. Homeless. They're undocumented parents. I would argue you better find a better source, man.
No, thank you. I'll continue to look into the case. But I just wanted to raise, when we think about children, right, I think we tend to think about children not as children who are working, but there are instances where children are working, engaging in adult kinds of labor that we might not typically imagine. Another case, right, where we're thinking about children are a group in society to be protected. We want to protect their innocence. So I have family separation at the U.S. border is another case that's going on right now, thinking about what is happening to children in society. Are they being protected? Are they not? And then the case that's maybe most interesting to me, because this is out of my own faith tradition, but it's not just in the Catholic Church, the cases of sex abuse of minors in the Catholic Church. When we think about what it means to be a child in the household of God, I think we have all of the questions that we've already raised about what does it mean to be mature, what does it mean to take responsibility, what does it mean to be inheriting a status, but we also have questions about what are the real experiences of children in our world that might inform the way that we think about this image of child. So for me, this one is the most interesting because if we continue to think about ourselves as children in the Christian community, how are we going to step up and take responsibility for protecting others around us, right? If we think we are the children, we are the ones who are to be protected, we don't have the authority yet, someone else is in charge, are we culpable in some way allowing these things to happen by not changing the authority structures or taking them for ourselves.
I think that another issue with this child father image is that we assume we're going to be protected and taken care of. Mm-hmm. And so I have a friend who considers himself a very dedicated church person, who in a class we were in together didn't get there on time. And when someone said something about setting the alarm, he said, if God had meant for me to be here, he would have waked me up. So there's sometimes it's used an excuse not to take care of ourselves or be responsible for ourselves.
And for ourselves or for others, right?
Right.
I think that that's, yeah, please.
A couple of things.
Yeah.
I'm an incest survivor.
Okay.
Long-term father. So I have had
Thank
to work through
sharing.
a lot of father stuff. But I think that for me, when I think of children and think of girls, mm-hmm. I think of the hideous sex trafficking all over the world done by people that we think are normal men, and then they turn out, I mean, I didn't know Jeffrey Epstein or whatever his name was, but, you know, children are being forced into sexual slavery, mm-hmm. babies, mm-hmm. And if they grow up and they don't die, they're terribly scarred, mm-hmm. and it's huge. I mean, it's way more people than migrant workers or separated children at borders.
Yes.
And I don't know that we're addressing that in the church at all, mm-hmm. very much.
Mm-hmm. And thank you for sharing, I appreciate that. One of the things that I am thinking with is how are these metaphors maybe holding us back from stepping up to deal with some of the problems that we face, right? And these metaphors have larger reverberations. It's not just in the church where people might not be stepping up to take responsibility. It's also in our wider society. So if I'm a child of God, God is going to protect me. God is going to take care of things. How does that metaphor empower me? And how does it maybe not empower me or make me think that I don't need to do work that I need to do?
Or to think of God as Father.
Mm-hmm.
Your Father is beautiful.
Right. Right. And it's the second layer that becomes interesting is when you think about Paul claiming this authority as I am like a parent, right, for you. Have we transferred that kind of authority onto leaders in the church? Are we saying the leaders in the church are like our parents and we are like the children? And what does that do to our sense of responsibility?
Right. Do you think that's more a Catholic concern?
No.
I do believe it's changing, particularly since we have so many women who are now ordained. But I'm talking about the Lutheran Church, I don't know about any other. But it's still, I think, very pervasive. It's such a part of our long-term structure, particularly for people of our age, that it's difficult sometimes to think in other terms.
Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that I would like to suggest is if we want to change the authority structures that are operating in the church, maybe we need to change the kinds of metaphors that we're using or the way that we're seeing those metaphors, right? And so I like to bring in the knowledge from the ancient world to think about what did this mean when Paul was writing it? Does it mean the same thing to us today? Are we using it the same way? Or are we bringing in a different kind of valence that might be damaging? Or is the metaphor damaging to begin with, right? Is it already problematic when it's first used? And so, or it wasn't problematic then, but it's problematic for us to hold on to it now. Are there ways that we need to change the way we talk about ourselves as community break down problematic structures? Please.
I know one of the things that drove me away from the Catholic Church was the idea that I couldn't really know or interact with God except through the priest.
Mm.
And that, you know, the priest is called Father. So, you know, as a child, that upset me and was something that made, ultimately, it became a Lutheran.
Sure.
I did not like that hierarchical structure that I, you know, you have to obey. You know, I've always been rebellious.
Well, we had that. The very first passage we looked at, right, has the idea of admonishment or discipline from the parent to the child.
Right.
And so when we think about ourselves as children, is that just built in and we expect that we don't have the option not to receive that discipline, right? Yeah, I saw another hand.
So one of the things we can talk about in terms of metaphor also is not just, is this metaphor helpful or is this metaphor damaging? But every metaphor reveals something and conceals other things.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the questions we might ask along these lines is, what does this metaphor encourage us to think about, and what does this metaphor actively prevent us from thinking about, and how does it fit into broader structures, right?
And that's a nice transition to these final passages, and I put two side by side. From slightly later in Galatians, my little children for whom I am again in the pain of childbirth until Christ is formed in you. That's really interesting, because at the same time, you are the child who Paul is bearing, and you are maybe the one who has Christ forming in you so that you can give birth and be a parent. I wish I were present with you now and could change my tone, for I'm perplexed about you. So there's that admonition again, or the parent's perplexity. And then we have this idea, the second passage from 1 Corinthians 3, back to immaturity versus maturity, right? So there are different ways in which that image of childhood gets used. Is it about becoming a mature member of the community through receiving the teaching and being nourished and nurtured? Is it about an inherent status, right? You are a child. Or is it about an adoptive status? You become a child and then are an heir in the community. I think it's a very complicated metaphor that, as Jacob helpfully points out, can do some really good things. It's very accessible. It is that image of God as loving parent.
But you are expected to grow up. Right?
Talk
about maturity and rights.
I wish I would.
Yeah. Even now you are still not ready. When we read that, does that, I don't think it should absolve us from stepping up, but when we read that, we might comfortably sit back and say, well, I'm still not ready, I'm still mature.
I would like to say, and I don't know how many people here have read it, but the ELCA has put out a document on women and their roles, and encouraging the study of all congregations to look at that document. And the draft, at least, was put out. Now, I believe, maybe there's some people in here who know a lot more about it than I did. I know we studied it among my circle, but I believe the draft was adopted at the last
convention.
So if you haven't read that, I would encourage you to go in and read that. At least they were trying, you know, they're looking at the subject. Mm-hmm. And trying to do something about it and asking for information and input from people in the congregations mm-hmm. to do something about it. So
thank
I
you.
Just wanted to
yeah.
add
thank
that.
You. And I am going to be mindful of our time here and let everybody go have your coffee break and get on with the rest of your day. But I hope that this raises some more questions. This one maybe feels less cut and dry than yesterday. This is a big question. How do we deal with this metaphor and what it invites us to and what it might be shutting off. So I hope we'll continue the conversation. Tomorrow at 9 a.m., we will be talking about athletes and the athletic metaphor and what we do with that as a community. But I'm just gonna keep throwing these at you. Please keep sharing your ideas with me about things I should read and things we should talk about.
Thank you.
I appreciate you all very much. Thank you.